So thanks everyone for coming. It's my pleasure to introduce Professor Adam Rees, who is visiting us from Johns Hopkins University. Adam got his PhD in 96 at Harvard, working on supernovae. And he's been active in the field, working on supernovae and cosmology for a long time. He's won various prizes. I have a list here, which I'm going to go through in the order of importance. Let's see. So there is a Helen Warner Prize for Astronomy, Shaw Prize in Astronomy, Albert Einstein Medal in 2011, and also there's a small thing, the Nobel Prize in Physics, I think. That's what it's called, okay. And that's for the discovery of acceleration of universe, more commonly known as dark energy, that he won together with Saul Perlmutter and Brian Schmidt. So let's see what else I have to mention. So Adam has been one of the leading observational cosmologists, and his discovery was in particular based on his observations of supernovae 1A and how they could be used as standard candle, and more importantly, a study of their behavior at large redshifts, large cosmological distances, suggests that the expansion of the universe is speeding up rather than slowing down. That was the direct evidence for what we now call dark energy. Now, Adam, one of the reasons that he's here is he's aiming for his second Nobel Prize because he's discovered a new hint for new physics, a newer physics. I guess dark energy is not old physics. So the question is, what's going to be next? And that's what he's going to tell us about now.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me. It's true that I'm aiming for a second Nobel Prize, but I'm aiming for it in peace. So if George Efstathiou is listening, because we're going to have some discussion afterwards, I come in peace. And you know, if George and I can work things out between the early and late universe, I think both of us will deserve a Peace Prize. Just kidding. This is all tongue in cheek. I'm actually told that George can listen, but he can't speak, so he can't criticize. That's a nice feature. Okay, enough jokes. I am going to tell you about recent progress in measuring the expansion rate of the universe using parallax and Cepheids and supernovae and everything we can get our hands on, how this might be hinting at the presence of new physics, or at least something else that's surprising. The details of this, if you want to read about, are contained here. I'm just going to point to the lower screen, but I see people in the back might not be able to see that. So you might take a look at this paper, most recent from the SHOES team, describing this work. I was told this was a colloquium rather than a regular conference talk, so I assume there'll be graduate students and maybe even some string theorists. So I'm going to give this like a colloquium style meaning. I'm going to give a little bit of background first before I jump into the latest stuff. The background will be 10 minutes or so, and then we'll move on from there. Okay. So one of the only ways we have of learning about the composition, age, and fate of the universe is by observing the universe expanding around us. We know the universe to be homogeneous and isotropic on large scales and to obey general relativity. And from these facts, we can derive an equation of motion for the universe, how the scale factor A that you see growing there, how that will change with time as a result of the gravity of the different components of the universe. This is encapsulated in, of course, the famous Friedmann equation. And so the observer's goal is to try to measure the function A of t, the left-hand side, to try to infer those interesting things, the physics, on the right-hand side. Now, we cannot directly observe A or t, but we observe proxies for both of these. So instead of A, we observe redshifts. Those are closely related by the inverse. Instead of time, we observe or try to measure distance. This is a little bit harder, though the relationship is clear to time via the speed of light. So I'm going to be talking a fair bit about distances in this talk. Now, we used to think 20 years ago or so that the universe was so simple that really all we needed to know was just the first two derivatives of A. By measuring those, we would learn most of what we needed to know. And so the field of observational cosmology once was called the quest for two numbers, the first two derivatives of A. The first derivative of A, of course, is the expansion rate, or evaluated today, it's the Hubble constant. It tells us the size scale and age scale for the universe. This used to be uncertain to a factor of two, whether we lived in a large scale, 20 giga-year-old universe, or a small scale, 10 giga-year-old universe. And then, of course, the second derivative of A, known as the deceleration parameter, this was defined to be positive for deceleration. We expected the universe's expansion to be slowing because of the gravitational attraction of matter in the universe. A really fundamental question was, is there enough matter in the universe to stop the expansion and have it recollapse? Is there enough to indicate that omega matter is greater than one? This also would tell us about the geometry of space, the ultimate fate, a little bit about whether inflation, which predicted that omega would be one, was consistent. And so, therefore, it was interesting to go out and try to measure that quantity. And to my mind, the 1990s was kind of a special time in this subject, because it's when some really powerful long-range standard candles, distance indicators, became available that allowed us to address these questions, which really had been around for decades before. Now, I'm going to be discussing two primary kinds of standard candles. I think these are the best and most famous standard candles. The type 1a supernovae, these are exploding white dwarf stars which attain the Chandrasekhar mass. The details of exactly how they do that are a little unclear, but we use these in a mostly empirical fashion. These are as bright as a billion or 4 billion solar luminosities, but they're relatively rare. There's only one in a galaxy like ours about every 100 years. So we can't expect to frequently find these in the nearby volume. That's why we often rely on a fainter but more common standard candle, Cepheid variables. These go back 100 years in terms of use. These are stars where they are pulsating, supergiant stars pulsating, because they're constantly overshooting hydrostatic equilibrium. There's an opacity in their atmosphere that runs away and makes you constantly go back and forth around the equilibrium. The period of the pulsation ties very closely to the density and the mass scale and luminosity scale of the star from theory, from pulsational theory, and empirically this is true as well, though we calibrate them again empirically. And so why we love these standard candles, of course, is because they allow us to measure distance by some knowledge of their luminosity, or even the knowledge of consistency of their luminosity. If we can even standardize them better, then we can measure relative, if not absolute, distances. Now, there are complexities sometimes. Sometimes the standard candles are not perfectly standard, and so we use empirical tools to sharpen them up. Another complexity sometimes is dust, particularly interstellar dust in the hosts of these standard candles. We're pretty familiar with interstellar dust, though, and in particular, we have a very good understanding of what the amount of dimming is at a certain wavelength for a given amount of shift in the color. And so with good knowledge of the colors of these standard candles, we can usually correct for dust along the line of sight, but it can be problematic. So as I said, the 1990s was a special time, particularly for the type 1a supernovae. It is when these empirical correlations between the light curve shape and the luminosity of the supernova, as well as the colors, were brought into use so that we could really improve the individual distances to these supernovae. So this is the first sort of large sample of nearby type 1a supernovae really used for cosmology. These are actually two samples, the most important of which is from the Kalantololo survey. This was done in the south. In Chile in the 1990s, and then in my own thesis in the north at Harvard, we collected a comparable sample, the points in red. And so what you could see here is you could really very precisely see the expansion of the universe. In fact, the individual distance precision per supernova is good to about 6%. This demonstrated the linearity of expansion and that with these kinds of corrections for luminosity and color, that these were really exquisite tools for cosmology. Now, a bit of a primer for string theorists or people who aren't used to astronomy units. This is not actually distance, it's logarithm of distance, which usually comes in the units of magnitudes that astronomers like so much. The handy thing about magnitudes is we don't have to define an absolute distance or reference that is just contained in this variable here, c, in order to talk about the relative distances. But in the magnitude scale, this is your one key lesson here, is a change in five magnitudes of logarithmic distance in the units that we use is a factor of 100 in brightness of the object, which is a factor of 10 in distance. Now, if we want to know the actual Hubble constant, then we need absolute distances, true distances, in which case we will need to learn about this constant c. However, in the meantime, and this is chronologically how this worked, even when knowledge of the absolute of the Hubble constant lagged to 10 or 15% uncertainty, the relative distances were better than that. So, as many of you probably are aware, two teams went out and observed type 1a supernovae then at greater redshifts, about a redshift of a half or so. And when they compared those to the nearby ones, and this comparison is done here by subtracting off a low mass universe but without dark energy, then what we saw is that the more distant ones were fainter, implying more expansion, or in other words, that we needed something like the cosmological constant to explain the acceleration that we were actually seeing. Now, at the time, we worried that there was some other kind of astrophysical dimming that could cause the more distant supernovae to just look faint, not actually be further away. Now, the kind of astrophysical dimming that we imagine, that people in the community imagine, were either that the supernovae in the early universe were born fainter somehow, different ways to cook that up, or that there was some kind of gray fog or dust in between galaxies that was dimming. And if either of these were true, the further back you looked, the more of this dimming you naively would expect. Whereas if we were really seeing a mixed dark energy, dark matter universe, then dark matter becomes dominant in the early universe. We know this is true because we see structure grows by gravitational instability. And so this effect sort of turns over, and going out looking for supernovae beyond a redshift of one would be a powerful test. And so in the early 2000s, we targeted doing that with the Hubble Space Telescope. At the same time, the community and many teams, ground-based teams, went out and observed many more type 1a supernovae, because after all, this is not very much information to rest a conclusion like this on. So over the next decade, the data that looked like this went to looking like this: about 1,300 type 1a supernovae, well-delineated expansion, objects well beyond a redshift of one found with the Hubble Space Telescope, so that you can really bin up this data and see that we really are tracking with supernovae an accelerating universe now and a decelerating universe in the past. And also to add that one can see to within about 10% precision that the dark energy accelerating the universe looks a lot like lambda, might even be lambda, but you know that didn't have to be true in the beginning when we first saw this effect. So it's interesting now to look back 20 years, and it's been since this discovery. If you look at the best supernova compilations to date, and I think the best just at this moment is from Dan Skolnick, who's a former graduate student of mine. He compiled the Pantheon sample, which is a homogeneously calibrated sample of cosmological supernovae. And when he refits the contours in the omega matter, omega lambda plane, you get this tight little constraint here, which happens to live quite close to the center of the discovery sort of results that we had 20 years ago, showing that we were relatively lucky. Nevertheless, the evidence now at this point is about six sigma for, just from supernovae, the existence of dark energy or an accelerating universe, And of course, it becomes much stronger when you add in baryon acoustic oscillations and the cosmic microwave background data. And I know that George is going to speak after me about cosmic microwave background and BAO data, so I won't say that much more about that at this point. However, of course, this raises what I think is probably one of the biggest, if not the biggest, unsolved problem in cosmology, which really is, why is the universe accelerating, or what is going on? And so our best three guesses are either that we truly have vacuum energy, i.e. the cosmological constant. This is sort of the unholy marriage of an idea from quantum mechanics that there should be energy in empty space, and general relativity, that if you had energy in empty space, it would give you this repulsive gravity and cause the universe to accelerate. There's a terrible quantitative mismatch between these two ideas, which keeps it more still as an idea. There is an important test of this, though, at least, that we see the equation of state of that dark energy be minus one at all times, because it's constant energy density. Another possibility would be a scalar field. The potential energy of that scalar field would temporarily act like vacuum energy, but it might not always be that way. We've seen this before. We think in the early universe, inflation was scalar field dark energy that did decay away, otherwise we wouldn't be here. And so we might be seeing that now. The hint would be that we see the equation of state not be minus one at some time, or we see a derivative that indicates that. A third possibility being that we've broken gravity, we've broken GR, that, you know, looking on horizon scales, we see the universe behaving in a different way that has a scale dependence. And so you might hope to learn about that by measuring the equation of state of dark energy on different scales, on the larger scales of the expansion and on smaller scales of the growth of structure, and see that those two disagree, that you didn't have a consistent picture of dark energy on different scales. So I don't really know which of these ultimately is right, but it is much easier to do a calculation with hypothesis one than two or three. And so the way we play the game now in cosmology, and I think rightfully so, is we assume number one is right, and we use it to calculate things, to calculate the results of cosmological experiments, and then we look for departures. We look for observational evidence that doesn't match that. And so that is what the rest of this talk is going to be based on, that idea, to assume plain vanilla lambda CDM and hunt for departures. So that was the background portion of this talk. This is the regular talk starting now. So after 100 years of cosmological research, we have arrived at a standard model of cosmology, vanilla lambda CDM, which has six free parameters and a number of ansatz, which are tested along the way, but is dominated by dark components whose physics we don't really deeply understand. However, we can do calculations with this by making some simplified assumptions about the dark parts of the universe. And then when the model of the universe looks like this, that is before recombination, we can use that model to calculate the physical size of fluctuations in the early universe plasma, including the sound horizon and including the baryon density. We can then compare those calculations to the angular size of fluctuations observed in the cosmic microwave background and best observed with the Planck satellite. But alternatively, we could compare them to our estimate of omega baryon from deuterium abundance measurements as an alternative route. And those comparisons between the predicted and those observed serve to calibrate lambda CDM. They serve to set down those six parameters. They're often used as well to test the ansatz. And then we use the evolving form of that calibrated model, which slowly evolves from looking like this to looking like this, to predict the expansion history of the universe. The expansion history of the universe. Although the model predicts the whole expansion history of the universe, we have high redshift baryon acoustic oscillations and supernovae, which act sort of like guardrails for the expansion history. They don't tell us we're on the right road, but they keep us from going off of the curves in the road that the model predicts. And finally, the model comes down and predicts the value of the Hubble constant today to about 1% precision, 67.4 plus or minus 0.5. And so a powerful end-to-end test of this whole story is then to measure the Hubble constant, and if we can, to comparable precision, 1% precision, to see is this whole story right, including some of the assumptions of simplification of the dark components of the universe. So we started a project a little more than 10 years ago called SHOES, not a very good acronym, but we were trying to come up with something quick, to try to measure the Hubble constant 2% level precision by devising a very simple ladder using what we thought were the most robust tools at that time, which is just using geometry to calibrate the luminosity of those Cepheids that I talked about, and using those to calibrate the luminosity of the type 1a supernovae. Now, there were two ways we thought we could do better than past results. One was we really saw a number of places along the measurement chain where we could reduce systematic errors by collecting the data in a more consistent way, by better matching of the data along the rungs. And I'm going to describe that as we go, as well as to make the observations in the near infrared, which is a great way to get away from dust. We thought we could more thoroughly propagate the systematic and statistical errors and keep track of the covariance between the data and model so that we can get a really complete picture of what the total uncertainty was. So I'm going to walk you through these measurements now. More or less at a cartoon level, they look like this. Very nearby, maybe at the kiloparsec scale, like even in the Milky Way, you can measure geometric distances, for example, by parallax. You might measure those two Cepheid variables in the Milky Way. At an intermediate distance at the megaparsec scale, more like, I think, 20 to 40 megaparsecs, are galaxies which recently hosted type 1a supernovae in which the Hubble Space Telescope can observe Cepheid variables. And then, of course, at gigaparsec scales are the supernovae well out into the expansion of space. So I'm going to walk you through these to give you a feel for the measurements in each of these steps. And I'm going to start out with parallax, because parallax is the simplest. This is sort of the gold standard of measuring distances. So you learn in Astro 101, if you took it or taught it, that parallax is simple. It's just geometry. There's no physics involved. The Earth goes around the sun. We know the baseline, the astronomical unit. So when we look at a distant star, it will appear to move back and forth. And if we measure that angle, we can measure how far away it is. The problem is that stars are very far away, and so therefore the angles become very small. So I wanted to come up with one example where you could see parallax with your naked eye. And this is probably the only example where you can. This is the nearest star, Proxima Centauri, and this is a series of observations from the Hubble Space Telescope, so exquisite resolution. And so the motion you see over the course of a few years, this curlicue motion, is the superposition of this straight line or drifting motion, the parent motion, and the parallax motion. And so if you watch this, you have seen parallax with your naked eye, right? Because any motion perpendicular to the drifting motion is strictly due to parallax. The problem becomes that the stars we're interested in measuring the distances to, Cepheids, which are still relatively rare, are typically thousands of times further away. And so this angle becomes thousands of times smaller, okay? So this, of course, is well known, that you can't reach much of the Milky Way with parallax. In particular, we're interested in some of the longer period Cepheids, which are the best analogs to ones we see in other galaxies, which are more like 3 kiloparsecs away. And so we are trying to measure a motion back and forth of just 1/100th of a pixel, measuring one star every 6 months, moving 1/100th of a pixel. That might sound pretty difficult. Actually, it is. To look at it more specifically, you're measuring the position of a star and another star. We can imagine this one's infinitely far away, and this is our target. And that over the course of 6 months, we're looking for this 1/100th of a pixel motion. It turns out we can only centroid a star to about 1/100th of a pixel with great knowledge of the point spread function of the telescope. So a few years ago, a number of us came up with a cute idea to improve these measurements. Instead of taking an image like this, to spatially scan the telescope along one axis so that you essentially get repeated measurements very economically. And so basically you're doing this, you're scanning in one direction, and so each of these points turns into a line, and now you can compare the separation between these stars many, many, many times to beat down these errors. If you're confused what I'm talking about, I literally mean that we are dragging the telescope along one axis so that the stars go flying by, and you get these nice parallel lines, and at a pixel by pixel level, you can repeatedly measure the separation. So here's a tiny patch of one of these images. And so this is a technique we developed over a few years. You then go in and you extract, scan by scan, the individual stars. So each of these lines now represents one single star scanning along. And if you line them up in time, when they are imaged, you see something quite interesting, this kind of noise that you see. First, we were confused by this. What is this noise? You realize, well, it's coherent. The noise is exactly the same for all the stars, or pretty much the same. That's because as you're scanning in one direction, the telescope is bouncing a little bit in the other direction, the perpendicular direction. That's fine because we only care to measure the changing separation between two stars. So we are always looking at the difference between two lines. So you take the difference between one and another, and that what we call jitter noise cancels out. That's even better than direct imaging. And it gives you a nice smooth line. Then you could average over thousands of pixels. With this technique, we found we can reach 20 to 40 micro arc seconds. So it's about an order of magnitude better than the best people had previously been able to do. So fast forward 4 years later, we picked out 8 Milky Way Cepheids and we observed them every 6 months. And for each of the Cepheids, after we subtract off the proper motion, this back and forth wiggle you see is just the parallax. 1 over that, of course, is the distance. And so we found with a set of 8 of these, we can measure a mean calibration of about 3.3%. Do you have a question?
Yeah, just to give an imagination, how part of the Milky Way can be measured with this? Can we measure the whole Milky Way?
It just depends. It depends what signal to noise you need. And so the figure that you need is 20 to 40 micro arc seconds, and then you figure out, what distance and what distance precision you need, because we could reach the edge of the Milky Way, but not with as much precision as the nearby parts. So it just depends what signal to noise you need. And so this gave us a 3.3% calibration of the luminosity of the Cepheids, independent of everything else. Meanwhile, of course, we knew that Gaia, this great European Space Agency mission, was poised to deliver that or better precision over the entire sky. And so anticipating Gaia would come along a few years later, we also used the spatial scanning to measure the fluxes or the photometry of a much bigger set of Cepheids, about 50 or 60 of them, because we wanted them on the same photometric system, HST, as other Cepheids, but thinking Gaia is going to come in and deliver the parallaxes. Well, after data release 2, this set of 50, the parallaxes are not quite as good as the ones we have now, although in the future they should be better. This gave us another independent 3% calibration, and we hope to improve this further just in the next year after reducing some systematics in Gaia itself. And so you can now combine the three different sources of geometric calibration of the luminosity of Cepheids in the Milky Way and show the period luminosity relationship for those. The two new sources that I talked about, Gaia and HST together, cover the longer period range that matches what we see in supernova hosts, a pre-existing set of a handful of ultra-nearby Cepheids. They're shorter period, but could be observed with the previous technology, are shown here as well. Now, if Gaia reaches the precision that it is expected to reach, that they promised to reach in the next few years, then the set of 50 will be good enough to reach a 0.4% calibration of the Hubble constant, because we will have then the combination of the HST photometry system and Gaia parallaxes. So I'm really hoping we get there. Now, there are three different techniques or ways to actually measure geometric distances that are useful for the Hubble constant in what I'm going to talk about. So I've told you about parallax, and that itself measured three different ways. Another method that's been used lately, particularly with high precision, is the method of detached eclipsing binaries, particularly in the Large Magellanic Cloud. So these are orbiting, these are binary systems, and you can measure the physical size and the angular size of the star, and that gives you the distance. The way you get the physical size is you measure the radial velocity of the orbiting star through spectra, and then you measure the timing of the eclipsing events, and the product of those then gives you the physical size of the star. You then measure the angular size using a relationship for red giants that is calibrated between color and size or surface brightness using interferometry. And so that's a geometric as well. And so you get an angular size, a physical size, and that gives you a distance. And so this has been done to about 1.2% precision now in the Large Magellanic Cloud, and we could see Cepheids there. And then the third method is this very famous galaxy, NGC 4258, which has a supermassive black hole in the center. And for about 15 years, radio astronomers have been observing water clouds with mazing from the background that they can track their motion, their proper motion, and their acceleration, so they get a proper motion distance through the Keplerian motion of these water maser clouds. And now that is also good to about 1.5%. And so these are three independent ways to calibrate Cepheids. Now, step two that I talked about, this is really what the Hubble Space Telescope was built to do. It was really designed to have the resolution to pick out individual stars like Cepheid variables in nearby galaxies like the hosts of Type 1a supernovae. Now, in the previous generation of Hubble constant measurements from the early 2000s, they were sort of stuck using WFPIC 2, which was the first working camera, but it did not have great sensitivity, and so you can only observe Cepheids out to about 20 megaparsecs, and that's a small volume. In that volume, there's only a Type 1a supernova about once a decade, and so people were stuck calibrating these old historic supernovae with poor data sets. What changed quite dramatically is when the advanced camera and then wide field camera 3 were installed on Hubble, those doubled the distance that you could measure Cepheids, which increased the volume by a factor of 8, which means there's a good Type 1a supernova about every year or two. And so this allowed our team to just limit ourselves to the best supernova data, and it was still fairly plentiful. We were able to calibrate 19 Type 1a supernovae with Cepheids just a few years ago, and now we're in the process of just finishing off a doubling of that sample to 38. That should be done quite soon, and that will give us a complete sample of supernovae, all of them out to redshift 0.01, and I don't think there'll ever be a doubling again with HST because we've pretty much done all of them at this point, so this will be an important improvement in the set. So here are the Cepheid period luminosity relationships observed in each of the host galaxies of the Type 1a supernovae, observed in three bands, and then observed in these three different anchor galaxies. Now, a very important point, this is one of the key aspects which has reduced systematic errors over past measurements, is for the first time we are using the same telescope to observe our standard candle, the Cepheids, in both the anchor galaxy where it's calibrated and in the supernova host where it's applied. And so these past questions of what is the photometric calibration or flux calibration of a telescope, how many ergs per second do we receive at the detector between this telescope versus that telescope, drop out of the problem, okay? Because we're just comparing the relative measures. I think this is the only distance ladder that actually does it this way. And so we are observing with the same instrument, the same filters, and as much as we can, a very similar range of metallicity and periods. And I'll talk more about that in a minute. And this all really goes to reducing the systematics, as does this. We also now make our measurements in the near-infrared. HST Key project and previous generation did everything in the optical. But as you go to the near-infrared, and this is seen nicely in these period luminosity relationships, in the LMC that we measured with HST this year. As you go from the optical to the near-infrared, Cepheids become better distance indicators. They're more impervious to the dust in the galaxies. They have a metallicity dependence, which is smaller than compared to the optical. And so this is definitely a better place to be doing distance measurements, and that's what we do. The third step I won't say much about because there was so much previous work that has gone into this. This is just the Hubble diagram of type 1a supernovae and your ability to measure the intercept of that. We don't do this too closely. We don't do it within around 7,000 kilometers per second to avoid local flows, to avoid the impact of if we're in a local outflow or if there are motions around us that are coherent. And we don't go to too high a range if we don't go really above 0.15 because we don't want to be sensitive to changes in the expansion rate of the universe that would complicate your description of simply the Hubble constant. That information is already contained in high redshift supernova data sets and can be harvested there. So we use this sort of sweet spot here, I would say, that in our last iteration had about 220 type 1a supernovae. Okay, so then we do a simultaneous, kind of a multilinear regression, keeping track of, so here are the individual measurements in the rawest form, Cepheid brightness measurements in supernova hosts, type 1a supernova measurements, geometric distance priors, and then the model itself. By model, I just mean the parameters that it depends on, the period of the period luminosity relationship, the luminosity of type 1a supernovae, a metallicity dependence of Cepheids, however much it exists, and then a regression matrix that keeps track of the covariance between the data and models. And at the end of the day, the determination of the Hubble constant really just comes down to two numbers. One, which comes from steps 1 and 2, is the fiducial luminosity of a type 1a supernova as calibrated by geometry and Cepheids. And then 2 is just simply the intercept of the Hubble diagram, and those together go into measuring the Hubble constant. So this is what the data actually looks like then. This is a visualization of the distance ladder where we have 5 different sources to relate geometry to Cepheids, the 3 flavors of parallaxes, and then NGC 4258 in the LMC. I also put M31 there as well. We don't use it as a primary anchor, but it is available and gives a very consistent result. The 19 places where Cepheids are used to calibrate supernovae, and then the few hundred supernovae in the Hubble flow. And as of the last month or two, with some improvements in distance anchors, here's where we're at, 73.5 plus or minus 1.4, a total uncertainty of 1.9%. And yes, you may realize this is about 4.2 sigma away from the CMB Planck plus lambda CDM value. I will say more about that in a minute, but I want to go over some estimates of robustness and systematic uncertainties first. So let's break out then what you actually get from the individual anchors themselves for the Hubble constant. So I have all 5 sources here, NGC 4258, the LMC detached eclipsing binaries, and these 3 flavors of Milky Way parallaxes. And I list just the distance uncertainty. That's the part that's independent for each of these. The value of the Hubble constant that you would get and how different that is and the uncertainty of that relative to the mean of 73.5. These are all relatively consistent. I will point out, because George pointed it out to me, rightfully so, that 4258, coming in here at the lowest, it's 1.5 lower, plus or minus 1.1. But if you remove 4258 from the mean, right, then the mean itself goes up more like to 74, 74.5. And so the difference then would creep up to about 2 or 2.5, which with that error bar gets you around 2 to 2.3 sigma difference. It's maybe I would say mild curiosity, but you know, not something yet at the level where we can say anything more profound than that. And you know, taken as a set of 1 out of 5, it's not crazy to have something at that level. But since George is speechless right now, I thought I would take the liberty of pointing that out for him. Okay. Now, from a statistics standpoint, it's obvious that this is a very strong result because we're looking for essentially a 2/10 of a magnitude error or discrepancy, which is just not in the cards statistically from any of one of these 3 steps, from the anchor step, from the calibrator step, or from the Hubble diagram step. It would look like the dashed red line being going through the data. But what about systematics? So we came up with 23 variants of ways to do our analysis, varying things like what kind of dust is in the galaxies that host type 1a supernovae, from how we do outlier rejection for Cepheids, and that's normally about 2% of objects, whether we correct the Cepheids for extinction at all, whether we assume there's a metallicity gradient and a Cepheid dependence on metallicity or not, whether we restrict the period luminosity range to more than 10 days, cutting out short period objects, or less than 60 days, what kind of supernova fitter we use. Some people use MLCS, some use SALT-2. What kind of environments the supernovae live in these galaxies. So in the Cepheid host, those are all spiral galaxies with star forming, with active star formation. So we can limit the Hubble flow sample as well to just spiral galaxies with active star formation. And so you can see there's small variations in the Hubble constant, but they're not very large. That's partly by design of trying to balance the samples, but we quantify the dispersion of these as an additional systematic error in our final measurements. Okay, so what's been happening over the last 20 years, going back to the HST Key Project, is that the uncertainty has been coming down every few years by attacking these various sources of error, and this is sort of a description here of the error budget of what has gone into this. And so in some ways you see a flattening of this as well as we try to work on whatever is most difficult. The main improvements since 2016 have really been the anchors. The Milky Way parallaxes have gotten better, the Large Magellanic Cloud Detached Eclipsing Binaries have gotten better, NGC 4258. We also have done a better job of matching the Cepheid photometry, we are matching it now, and calibrating the Wide Field Camera 3 better. What has not changed very much is actually the value of the Hubble constant. It has stayed remarkably consistent over the last period of time. In fact, just before this talk, I put together a compilation of every viable measurement I could find that used Cepheids to measure the Hubble constant. And here's the last sort of 20 years in time order. So from 2001, the Key Project, all the way to the present value that I'm talking about, you could see the error has certainly been going down, but the central value is extremely narrow in here. And these are with different sets of Cepheids, completely different observers. Each of these I've kind of added a note. It was done in the optical or the near-infrared with a recalibration or a different near-infrared camera like NICMOS versus Wide Field Camera 3, using different fancy statistics, Bayesian hierarchical or Bayesian hyperparameter modeling, or Georgiev Stathiou's value is in here as well. I think that it's pretty clear that this is the sort of value that people get from this. I think dead horse is fairly tender at this point. Now, a very important test, though, of unknown systematics, of course, is to compare to other techniques, other measurements. And so we had a great conference just about a month and a half ago at KITP in Santa Barbara, where six groups were presenting brand new results just this year from the late universe, the present time measurement of the Hubble constant. And so I show those here. There are sort of four that you need to think about. One is the supernova distance ladder. So these are different ways of calibrating the luminosity of type 1a supernovae, either Cepheids, MIRAs, TRGB, or it can be done with strong lensing. Then there's the surface brightness fluctuation distance ladder. Surface brightness is another way of measuring the distance to a galaxy by statistically its smoothness. And then there are single shot methods like the Holy Cow strong lensing or the masers directly into the Hubble flow. And so a naive combination, and then in some of these cases, I have included the different anchors or different results that people have gotten from different anchors. So that's why some of these have multiple values, like tip of the red giant branch. And I could say more about that if people have a question. There are some differences here in the way people measure and calibrate tip of the red giant branch. But a naive combination of these would give you 73 plus or minus 1. However, you shouldn't do the naive combination because particularly in this group of supernova distance ladders, they're using very similar samples of supernovae and things like that. So the simplest thing to do without doing a PhD project on how to optimally combine these things is to order from my prefix menu, okay? The prefix menu, like many prefix menus, right, you get to order, you know, your main course from one category. This is category one, so you pick one thing from here, okay? You get to pick one thing from category two, okay? And then everybody gets dessert, right? So everybody gets three, and everybody gets, you know, the cheese board afterwards. So that, you know, would be category four, because these have no overlap with things up here. So you can realize an independent measurement from one something in category one plus something in category two plus three and four. Now, because this is cosmology, right, everybody also has something that they're uncomfortable with, okay, some measurement that they don't like or whatever. I understand that. And so you also get, at this restaurant, a peremptory challenge. I don't know if the Canadian legal system has the same concept, but you know, you could look at a panel of jurors and you could throw one out without any reason, right? No profound reason, okay? You can't throw the whole jury out, otherwise, you know, then you have no result. So in this case, you could add one, two, three, four, and pick a challenge, okay? So we've done this exercise for you. And these are the different combinations that you could do from category one, two, three, and four with the different peremptory challenges. So, you know, up here is only Cepheid distance ladder, not Myra's or Cepheid's. And up here is Myra's, but not Cepheid's or TRGB. And over here are the different forms of TRGB and the different calibrations people have had. If you don't like supernovae at all, and why wouldn't you like supernovae? I don't know. But if you don't like supernovae, this is your value. You don't like lensing, this is your value. You don't trust something about the LMC, the Milky Way, or NGC 4058 as calibrators, or surface brightness fluctuations. There's a value for there for you as well. Now, one can play the same game in the early universe as well, the same general idea that you want to be able to have one peremptory challenge. And so here are different data combinations then for the early universe. If you like Planck and its TT spectrum, right, or full results, I should say. If you like the Planck full results, then you can use that in Lambda CDM and you get this very precise result. And here the challenge essentially is you're not using baryon acoustic oscillations. Now, alternatively, right, you could use Planck without TT, or you can skip the CMB altogether by using omega baryon as determined from deuterium abundance to calculate the sound horizon, which calibrates baryon acoustic oscillations, and you would get this value without the CMB at all. Or you can use three other CMB experiments. You could use WMAP, ACT, or SPT, and combine those with BAO. So here, your peremptory challenge is no Planck, but these different CMB data sets. Again, there's a little bit of movement here, but you get a very sort of consistent picture of what's going on. And so to really put this into form, right, we're going to go from this, your, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 ways of forming the late, and 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 ways of forming the early, into a 6 by 11 matrix that shows you what these differences are. So this is the tension matrix, okay? And so first I'm showing you this, and I'm showing you those 11 combinations here on the bottom, so you can still pick your favorite, and the 6 here from the early universe, you can pick your favorite. But I've ordered them in terms of claimed precision. This is important, okay? So the things that, the measurements that claim the greatest precision are here up in the upper left, okay? So that's obviously Planck, and that's obviously shoes using the Cepheid results, all the way to things with less precision, like throwing away supernovae, or using a Big Bang nucleosynthesis to calibrate BAO. Now, what's important is you should be looking at, are the differences driven by the things with highest or lowest precision, just the pure differences? Because I've heard people sometimes suggest that, oh, the things with greatest precision also have the greatest difference. That is suspicious. But that is actually not the case. You see this heat map, that things are quite evenly sort of distributed around precision. However, when now we jump to the significance matrix. So that was the value. Here's the significance. Now you expect the greater significance to be with the experiments that have the smaller uncertainties, because for a given difference in the actual value, that will be the case. So here I draw your attention particularly to, I would say, the Planck line, because, you know, as long as we find Planck is consistent with the other ways of doing the early universe, there's really no reason not to focus your attention on it, because it does have the greatest precision. You can see, really, no matter what you do, you're stuck somewhere between 4.1 and 6 sigma. In fact, I can now sort of group the different approaches that are used. So various ways of including Cepheids and the other things, and probably my preferred would be this left-hand corner, because it's simply the shoe's distance ladder with everything else. You're at about 5.7 sigma. But even the different ways of using tip of the red giant branch, and again, I'm happy to afterwards to go into what the differences between these are, get you anywhere from 4.1 to 4.8 sigma. Not using lensing at all, 5 sigma. Not using supernovae at all, 4.4 sigma. And so I think this gives you a pretty good idea. And again, you know, you can make your own choice about, you know, which data set you like and which challenge you want to make, but we're looking for a more holistic view of what's going on here. Now, a question that I am frequently asked is, could we live in a giant void which is causing this? And I see papers on this every month on AstroPH, and I'm sorry to say the answer is no, that we can't live in, it doesn't look like we live in that big a void. You would need a 9% change in the Hubble constant. It usually means a local matter density that's something like 50 or 60% higher than what you would have globally. We could live in a small void, more like 0.6%, and this is how we know this, and this is why we can rule out 9%. There's both a theoretical expectation. You take the large-scale structure, you know, you do simulations, large n-body simulations, on a cubic gigaparsec, and you vary the position of the observer, and this has been done by a number of nice papers, and they're all quite consistent that the one sigma variation you expect going in local to global Hubble constant in the volume that we're actually measuring, at least for shoes that we're measuring, is about 0.4%. So, you know, you're something like 20 sigma away from what you need in terms of actually living the right size void. But we can do this empirically as well, because if we lived in a giant void, the type 1a supernova Hubble diagram extends all the way to redshift 1 well sampled. And so if the void were anywhere in there, you would see a large inflection in the Hubble diagram. And so we looked for that inflection, a student of mine, Darcy Kenworthy and Dan Skolnick and myself, and the variations we actually see in the expansion rate, if we look at regions that would be inside or outside a putative void, are at the 0.6% level, in very good agreement with the theory prediction, and strongly rules out even the moderate size voids that people have suggested, let alone the sort of 9% void. So I think this is just not realistic at all, and yet I will still continue to see papers on this, I have no doubt, every month on AstroPH. But just so you know, it just does not seem to work empirically or theoretically. We have also beefed up the calibration of the Wide Field Camera 3 in order to try to reach 1% for the Hubble constant. See, at the end of the day, we are measuring the fluxes of things, and you have to make sure that you're getting linear measurements of fluxes. And so you can compare the known brightness ratios of objects as you would expect in the near-infrared using the overlapping wavelengths of an optical CCD. Optical CCDs and near-infrared arrays overlap around 0.9 microns, and then you can compare those to what you actually observe and measure the nonlinearity. Near-infrared detectors have nonlinearity. It can be large, like the first generation detectors that had a 3% nonlinearity. In the case of Wide Field Camera 3, we've calibrated the nonlinearity to be about 0.3%. And the uncertainty in the linearity calibration as a function of brightness, the uncertainty limits the contribution to the Hubble constant to about 0.3%. So there's no reason that nonlinearity in the camera should hold us back from being able to ultimately measure to about 1% precision. Okay, what is going on? What if you think that the early and late universe have a discrepancy or a problem, and in fact, we in this conference in Santa Barbara, we more or less voted that it was a problem. Between 4.1 and 5.8 sigma, there's a conference review you could find on the archive from Lichaverde, Tommaso Trejo, and myself. We concluded that this discrepancy does not seem to depend on any one source, method, or team. Then you have to start putting some more cycles of thought into what could cause this. And The truth is, I don't know. I mean, I'm far from telling you that I have an explanation. Here are some sort of cartoon-level ideas, I would say. If dark energy was not lambda, that could do it, except the guardrails from BAO and supernovae really limit this argument. You know, you could get at sort of 2 sigma, a change of about 0.08 in the equation of state, or in the derivative of about 0.08, and that maybe could get you halfway there before you start developing a new tension with that data, and you don't want to trade one tension for another tension. Alternatively, a sterile neutrino, depending on when it thermalizes, could be, and again, the CMB really limits you here. The damping tail doesn't want another neutrino, and you could push it to about 0.4, coming into sort of 2 sigma tension with the CMB, and that also only gets you about halfway there and is not particularly attractive from that standpoint. A little bit of curvature, again, strongly prohibited by the CMB, doesn't get you very far. I think more interesting, I'm going to say more about this in a second, more interesting are some recent ideas of adding new components or new action in the early universe before recombination that increases the expansion of the universe and shrinks the sound horizon. So things like a scalar field that is like dark energy, really, that boosts the expansion of the universe. Dark matter interactions could potentially do this too. In fact, if you want to think deeply about this, I recommend you first read this paper from a couple weeks ago by Knox and Malaya called The Hubble Hunter's Guide, where they go through what works and what doesn't work. And they're, in their words, the most likely is these class of solutions that increase the expansion rate in the 2 decades of expansion before recombination. That has the effect of speeding up expansion so the universe becomes transparent earlier, the sound horizon has not grown as much, in which case it effectively recalibrates the CMB scale and the BAO scale together. And there's a number of papers that describe this. The claims in at least some of these papers are that it fits the CMB a little better, I think delta chi-square of 4 or something like that, which I take to mean that it, at least it doesn't make it any worse, or that the CMB is fairly agnostic about the existence of these. But I think there's a lot of work still to do in this area as well, and so maybe people will take on that charge. So what we're doing is, as I said, our last rounds of improvement, which we think we'll accomplish in the next year or so, doubling the sample. These are all new host galaxies of type 1a supernovae. And already we have most of the Cepheid observations in hand. These are the Cepheid period luminosity relationships in each of these galaxies. In the near future, what I see is the doubling of the supernova sample. Hopefully Gaia Data Release 3 will really improve the precision and the systematics of the Gaia measurements. If both those things happen at the level expected, just by DR3, just in the next year or so, we ought to be able to get to about 1.3% uncertainty, which is still almost a 50% improvement over where we are now. We heard some talks about LIGO, measuring the Hubble constant in the late universe. We really look forward to that as well. I think the time scale of useful contributions there is probably the most uncertain thing because the rate is relatively uncertain of the events. We're all still looking at one event or more or less and wondering, you know, how often that'll happen. And so we're hoping that that is sooner rather than later. Things like DESI, LSST, W1st Euclid, these all are going after W of Z, but that's very helpful. Those are the guardrails that I talked about. The better we understand W of Z, the more we can remove that as, you know, either point the finger at it or more likely remove it as the source of what's going on. I'm also particularly interested in some of these predictions of scalar fields or other ways of increasing the expansion of the universe pre-recombination actually impart small signatures in the cosmic microwave background. The claim on some of them is that they're actually improving the fit by matching those signatures. But more importantly, future CMB experiments from the ground, S4 or the Simons Observatory or even some of the B-mode experiments should be able to go after some of those signatures. And so if that story is true, we should be able to really get some serious evidence that it is true, not just the discrepancy in the Hubble constant. So just some final thoughts that I want to say. We were chatting a little bit about this at lunch. We can sort of put this problem in perspective, at least how observationally difficult or not difficult in some ways it is, by looking at where we've come with type 1a supernovae. So here is the Pantheon sample, and if you believe in lambda CDM, here are the residuals of the supernovae. And the residuals here are sort of at the 3 or 4 hundredths of a magnitude level, much, much smaller than the 2/10 of a magnitude overall difference between the early and late universe. Now, 20 years ago, when my colleagues and I were measuring the acceleration of the universe, or for people today, measuring the equation of state of dark energy, you're essentially comparing supernovae at redshift of 1 to redshift of 0.05. And so that's a large range of redshift where you have to worry about evolution and what astronomers call K corrections, the shift of your energy from one bandpass to another that you have to cross-calibrate, as well as 0 points of different telescopes. Measuring the Hubble constant is almost an order of magnitude easier in many ways because you're comparing everything in the rest frame. You're only going between a redshift of 0.05, the Hubble flow, to the calibrators at lower redshifts than that. So it can all be done with the same telescope, same surveys, no worry about evolution, K corrections are negligible, no need to change 0 points because you're using the same telescope. So, and you know, this is a much bigger effect than the kinds of variations or errors we actually see doing the harder problem. So it would seem that this is something well doable by these measurements. And the last sort of big thought I want to share with you is there's an interesting history, I think, of the Hubble constant not matching our cosmological expectation, and that lack of matching teaching us something important or interesting about the universe. In the 1930s to 50s, the Hubble constant was thought to be more than 300, which implied the universe was only a billion years old, which of course is much younger than the age of the Earth. And what did we discover here? We discovered that there have been two generations of stars, and we were confusing one generation with the other generation when measuring the Hubble constant. And so that was a very important discovery and worth paying attention to. In the 1990s, there was a lot of debate about whether the Hubble constant was actually 60 or 85, but that entire range, with the expectation that omega matter was 1, implied that the universe was only about 10 billion years old, which of course is younger than the oldest stars. What was wrong there? Omega matter is not 1, right? We think omega matter is 0.3 and lambda is 0.7, and this changes this calculation quite a bit. So that was another thing we could have learned from that discrepancy. So here we are. Maybe this is, I don't know, the third major time in history when we've said, gee, you know, the Hubble constant is not matching our cosmological expectations. What are we going to discover from this? I have no idea. But I wanted to share that perspective with you. Okay, so I'll put up a few takeaways here, and I'm happy to take any questions that you have.
So wonderful. So as some of you noticed, our question and answer is a little bit of a athletic exercise because we have a microphone. So we're going to start with students, younger students, I guess, not the old ones like me. But so who's do any of the students have any questions? Very brave students who are not afraid to ask questions. Yes.
You were talking about the discrepancies between late time observations and early time observations. Is this one or the other, or can we look at something in between?
Right, that's a great question. So what about
to make a transition?
So I pose this like a late time versus early time. What about in between? And the answer is that it is really manifest as a scale problem. And the scale comes either early through the Hubble constant or late through the sound horizon. If you take something in between, everything we know in between has to get a scale from one end or the other. And so if you start at the Hubble constant, and this has been shown in papers, you can build your distance ladder measurements all the way back to predict the size of the sound horizon, and you will get a different answer. So historically, this could have been called the sound horizon tension or discrepancy. We don't have, what you really want is a third way to get an absolute calibration and maybe for that way to be in the middle. And we don't have anything like that. We don't have, these are absolute, this is a conflict of two absolute scales when we think the universe should have one, or the story, the model that we use to connect these two.
Okay, so I'm looking for another student. If they're, okay.
So according to current modeling, that is like say in the last year, what is the best theory to explain this? Like, you may have already gone through this, but I mean, at least like dynamical dark energy.
Yeah, well, you know, I'll say the least unlikely, maybe, I think that's how they described it. Oops, that's not where I wanted to go, is this idea here. Here we are. So this general idea that, and again, I would recommend that you take a look at this paper, but if you have a scalar field here, okay, at this time in redshift, so this is the buildup of the sound horizon, and most of the buildup of the sound horizon, that integral, occurs over the last two decades of expansion, just before recombination. So if you have a dark energy-like scalar field, and it only has to be like 5% of omega, so 5% of the energy density, if it pops up then, right, it will, just like we see with current acceleration or we saw during inflation, it will boost the expansion rate of the universe, and it will thin out the plasma faster, so it becomes transparent, and when it becomes transparent, the sound horizon is set. So it will cause that sound horizon to be smaller. Then it has to get out of the way, so it has to decay, so that it doesn't have effects on the damping tail of the cosmic microwave background. So you can put in by hand a scalar field to do that, and you could say, oh, okay, this looks like it. But you know, you would want to see like more evidence of that, maybe other features in the cosmic microwave background that are indicative of that. And so, you know, this is, I think, the first set of solutions that is possible. You know, people could argue it's there's so much fine-tuning involved in that. And while I'm sympathetic to that, as wearing my observer's hat, I think, you know, we have three, this would be the third episode of Dark Energy. They all seem finely tuned to me. I mean, you know, the current acceleration doesn't match what the particle physicists tell us the energy of the vacuum should be. And inflation has to be just right as well. Otherwise, you know, it doesn't end when we need it to end, or it doesn't produce some of the other early universe features. So I don't know if this is finely tuned or not. I just know that, you know, we would like to see more evidence.
Good, so we're gonna open up the questions. So John?
Two questions. So the first is, what's the status of the long-standing tension?
What's the status of what?
The status of a long-standing tension, namely the measurement of lithium locally at the star differs from its measurement at the Big Bang nuclear center by
right.
a factor of three. The second question is...
Right, the lithium abundance problem.
Yeah.
Right. I have not read on that in a while. I know that it existed for a while. I saw some papers where people said some certain kinds of dredge up in stars could change that. I've seen papers claiming that it was solved and that it wasn't. I don't know. I don't know what the status of that is. It's a good question. Generally, people use deuterium because it's thought to be less destroyed and simpler. And so they use deuterium abundance measurements to describe omega baryon, and they don't use lithium.
Second question is, what about the outlier measurement by Wendy Friedman using tip of the red giant branch?
Yeah, so I can address that here. The story there is, let's see, that one, this one. Okay, so the discrepancy really here is, so this is tip of the red giant branch, and here's Wendy Friedman's measurement, and it is the lowest, although, you know, at 1.5 sigma, it's not discrepant, so, you know, in some ways it doesn't really require any explanation. I mean, you have a bunch of measurements, you expect some of them to be that far away. However, it's easily traceable to the calibration of the luminosity of tip of the red giant branch they used. They used a calibration through the Large Magellanic Cloud. Tip of the Red Giant branch has a lot of extinction or dust in the Large Magellanic Cloud, and you have to estimate how much extinction there is. If you use the standard Ogle maps to estimate that extinction, then you get this answer, 72.4. if you use a different method that they used, then you get a lower value. But we pointed out in a paper a couple of weeks ago that there's a problem with that other method that they used, that it used some blended data. And if you account for that blending, then you would also get this higher value. I have a backup slide about this. Right. There's that backup slide here. These. Sorry, I'm just looking at a tiny little thumbnail. See it? Almost there, I think. Okay, yeah, here's the problem. So they used some data comparing the small Magellanic Cloud to the large Magellanic Cloud, and this is the paper you want to take a look at. And the data came from two different sources, one from the MCPS survey and the other from the Ogle survey. And there's a mismatch between those surveys. If you just take the exact same objects between those surveys, you see about 0.04 of a magnitude shift in I and 0.08 of a magnitude in V that you could trace to blending. If you avoid the blended data, which in this case turns out to be the MCPS data, if you just use the Ogle data, then it changes, and this is Friedman's estimate of the extinction in the LMC. Their estimate was this black line, which is more extinction, but if you don't use the Zaritsky data, but use the Ogle data in both places, and it's hard not to argue that that is the correct thing to do anyway, to use the same data source in both places, then it reduces the relative difference between the LMC and SMC. This is a little bit technical, but it gives you less extinction. And so, for example, here is the extinction that the Ogle maps give, and here's if we correct their photometry for this blending effect, you get a very similar result, and here's where they were. So they had estimated about 3 sigma more extinction than people previously had, and so when you do that, you get back to, you get the result that I showed before, which is very consistent with the other results. And I think that is the, yeah. So the difference between the extinction and the calibration is right here between those two.
So, all right, this is fine, okay. Sometime near the end of your talk, you had this slide where you say if we believe this 4 to 6 sigma discrepancy, that you add a bunch of things that you might do to get that tension smaller. Where is it?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the one. You didn't put modified gravity on there. Why not?
I didn't. I didn't have a good paper or a good model for what that is or what that does. If I had a good one, I would just add it to the list. Is there one you're thinking of?
No, not necessarily. Oh, but I guess I would have thought.
Right. I don't know. I don't know how to do that. I mean, it has to be done in a way that's self-consistent, that doesn't. Isn't inconsistent with so much else of what we have, that does rotation curves of galaxies right, that does the motions of galaxies right, that does the whole expansion history along the way right, and just does this. And I don't know if a paper like that exists.
Okay, thank you.
Yes? In the scalar that people use to sort of bridge this tension, How do the scales that come in compare with particle physics scale?
What does that mean?
I mean, you have to use some parameters in the scalar you're using to accommodate the tension, right?
I have to use some
parameters. Well, you don't use, but you showed this paper. Yeah.
I'm still not sure I'm understanding the question.
You showed us work where they use a kind of dark energy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so, sorry, what kind of scalar fields?
No, what kind of scales you use for the scalar field compared to particle physics scale? I mean, you have to use...
I think these are all non-natural. Sorry, I don't remember the values, but I don't think I've ever seen a dark energy scalar field that was invoked that was natural. That's what my particle physics friends tell me, at least.
Okay, so I'm going to try it a bit farther. Hey!
So will LIGO be giving an absolute measurement?
LIGO should give an absolute measurement because they have a standard candle. It's a standard candle in gravitational waves rather than in light, and that's great. you know, it's just a question of, you know, how precise those will be, on what time scale they'll come. I think it's, you know, that's a very exciting frontier area. I mean, today, there's one measurement, and it's equally consistent with both things. You know, you sort of, back in the envelope tells you you need something like 30 or 40 events like that. And, you know, in 2017, it felt like there'd be a couple every day. Now, it's been a couple of years since we've had another one, but, you know, maybe just as I'm saying this, two more will go off, I don't know. But anyway, so I would say it's the hardest thing to predict is the time scale and when that will weigh in.
So eventually, though, we will have an absolute intermediate redshift measurement.
No, it's not an absolute intermediate redshift. It's an absolute, I would say it's an absolute late universe measurement, because it's the exact same approach. You measure a distance, and if you have an electromagnetic counterpart, you have a redshift. It's just a different way of getting the distance. It's just a different way of getting a distance.
So you can't get that out of modeling the physics and then kind of...
The actual gravitational wave event itself and what you measure actually calibrates the mass, and so calibrates, it's like a standardized candle. It actually calibrates what luminosity or amplitude of the gravitational wave to expect, and then you observe it, and it actually, if you can calibrate it well enough, tells you absolutely how many megaparsecs away it is. So it's exactly a late universe measurement in the exact same way. It's just a standard candle in gravitational waves, not in light. I don't know if you want to add something to that. Oh. Well, that's the last question.
Sorry, there you are.
You might have answered this already, but you know, sometimes you get this fixed price menu and it doesn't actually have on it what you want.
Yes, yes. You go to another restaurant. Then. But this is the only restaurant in the universe, unfortunately. That's the problem. Oh, you wanted, wait, so you wanted other measurements?
I wanted to know whether you had something that you wanted down the line to add it to.
Yeah, well, you know, as I said, we have a kind of roadmap of getting to what I hoped was 1%, what I may admit it may only be 1.3%, but you know, our second half of supernovae and better Gaia information, and then you know, other things, LIGO or other measurements, CMB looking for signatures. These are all the things that I hope to see on a menu in a future restaurant.
Okay, any final, very last question? If not, so for everybody, there will be snacks outside. For the conference participants, we're going to meet again upstairs. Maybe I propose we start in 20 minutes or so, basically shortly before 3:40. And that we'll be back in the Bob room upstairs for the conference participants. So let's thank Adam again for the wonderful conference.